National news from a grassroots perspective, you're listening to Groundwire. Community news from coast to coast to coast.
Once it's been blasted, there's no way. Once you've taken an organ from yourself when we're operated on, it can never be replaced regardless.
I am here because my freedom is touched.
We are the quiet. The ones who drop out of classes because our rapist is sitting beside us. Who leave circles of friends because our rapist is intertwined. We lie about being too sick or too tired.
Outside the wall, this country is changing. But inside the Myanmar, we are still a lot of difficulties.
Hello and welcome to Groundwire. This is Jamie Bliss.
And I'm Catherine Fisher. Groundwire is a grassroots news program brought to you by the National Campus Community Radio Association.
Our first feature was filed by Una Jefferson reporting from CKUT in Montreal on a demonstration against the Quebec Values Charter, which happened on September 14th.
We'll also hear from Chris Albinotti from CFBX in Kamloops, BC, who reports on a protest against a highly controversial Ajax mine project proposed in that city.
Halifax poet laureate E.L. Jones shared an anti-rape poem at a recent rally at St. Mary's University in Halifax. The Halifax Media Co-op provided us with a recording of that.
Also, Portia Leray from CKUT in Montreal reports on the Golden Harp Taxi, an operation founded by three ex-political prisoners in Myanmar. Following up on a story Groundwire covered in our last episode, supporters of Tariq Loubani and John Grayson will gather at the Egyptian consulate in Montreal at 1 p.m. on Tuesday, September 24th. Grayson and Loubani were transiting through Cairo on their way to Gaza on August 16th when they were detained by Egyptian officials, and they've been held in Cairo's Tora prison ever since. Loubani and Grayson, both Canadian citizens, have not been told why they're being detained. Supporters are demanding that the Canadian government seek the release of Loubani and Grayson. You can find more information on this story at freeterrickandjohn.com. Some sad news from Free Speech Radio Network out of Berkeley, California. Unless the network's able to fundraise a substantial sum of money, they'll air their last newscast on Friday, September 27th. Since 2002, FSRN, a nonprofit run by its workers and reporters, has produced a half-hour daily national and international radio news program focusing on peace and social justice issues in the U.S. and around the world. FSRN's stories are also carried by community radio stations across Canada, and many Canadian journalists contribute to the program. For more information, you can see their website, fsrn.org, and you can also donate there.
Thanks to Catherine Fisher from CJLY in Nelson, BC for those headlines.
Welcome back to Groundwire, a biweekly nonprofit national news program produced by the community for the community. Groundwire is heard on dozens of community radio stations across Canada. And now for our feature stories.
On September 14th, many in Quebec marched against the Parti Québécois Charter of Values, which proposes to prohibit the wearing of religious symbols by public employees. Una Jefferson from CKUT Montreal reports for Groundwire.
On September 14th, 2013, an estimated 10,000 people gathered in Montreal's Place Émilie-Gamelin to protest the PQ's proposed Charter of Values. The protest then moved west to Place du Canada. This charter would ban all overt religious garb from being worn by employees in government-paid positions. This would include headscarves, kippas, and conspicuously large crucifixes. The charter would allow, however, earrings bearing the Muslim crescent, rings with the Star of David, and smaller crucifixes. There was a large Muslim and Sikh contingent at the protest, as well as enthusiastic representation from a huge array of religious and secular ideologies. The charter was largely seen as a racist and xenophobic move on the part of Marois, targeting Muslim women in particular. There's also some speculation that the charter has more political motives for the PQ.
Could you start off by telling me a little bit about why you're here?
I am here because my freedom is touched. Muslims' religion, I don't know how to say that, it's visé. Québécois, they just follow France. So they just look at Muslim people.
My Muslim women friends wear the hijab because they choose to wear the hijab. It's important to them for their religion and their spirituality. You remove that from them, you take a piece away from them. But a thing that's making me very angry about the whole situation that I'm hearing on the radios and stuff is that people who are for the charter are talking about women being oppressed by wearing the hijab, and that they want to change that before the equality of women throughout the world. From the women that I know who are very intelligent, very educated, who wear a hijab, that has nothing to do with it. And I wish that the people who put this charter together would understand and get to know these people rather than make assumptions.
I'm repulsed by what Marwa is doing with the Chartres, and I think it's indefensible and thoroughly obnoxious and divisive, and it's attempting to take attention away from the failing economy.
I think that Pauline Marwa has broken a lot of promises to a generation of sovereigntists. Also people that have a legacy of generations of free education. You know, she's maintained the prime de santé that she's requiring people to pay. She's made cuts to social welfare, and she's passing forward a policy of slowly increasing tuition fees. So faced with those kinds of promises that she's broken to a generation of Quebecois who believe in the état de providence, a welfare state, I think she's trying to create some sort of false consensus and the easiest and cheapest way to do that is through creating a false crisis, a false enemy, a false threat, and to pretend to save us all from that. But we don't need saving, so.
Yeah
absolutely. There is a lot of value to call for the separation between church and state. So a true state should be free of religion. That would mean taking off the cross. You know, we're hearing those very common responses, take off the cross from the National Assembly, take off the cross from Mount Royal, but more than that, assure full representation from the full gamut of this society, their representation in our institutions, and that's how we defeat the biases that exist currently in Quebecois and Canadian society.
Well, I'm here today because I'm supporting my multicultural family. My son is married with a Muslim. I'm Catholic by birth. We have all kinds of different religions in our family. We live in a polyglot, multi-diverse world, and I don't want to remain in a society that's going the wrong direction. René Lévesque said many years ago that a nation is judged by the way that we treat our minorities, and that's basically all I have to contribute.
For Groundwire, this is Una Jefferson reporting from CKUT Radio in Montreal.
Golden Harp Taxis is a Yangon-based operation founded by three ex-political prisoners in Myanmar. Members of Golden Harp Taxi share Yangon's hidden history and their experience as activists with visitors to Yangon. As Myanmar makes headlines around the world for reformist efforts and countries like Canada warm up to the current quasi-civilian government, Golden Harp Taxi members urge listeners to understand that the realities of most people in Myanmar are still shaped by the military government's long and repressive legacy.
Golden Harp Taxi is a Yangon-based operation founded by three ex-political prisoners who have collectively spent over 30 years in Myanmar jails since Myanmar's pro-democracy uprising in the summer of 1988. Luen Ma Tet and Chin Ming So, members of Golden Harp Taxi, spent an afternoon with me and explained Yangon's hidden history. From 1962 to 2011, Myanmar was under military rule. The military junta was ostensibly dissolved in 2011 following a general election in 2010 and a quasi-civilian government installed. Welcoming recent reforms in Myanmar, Canada eased its economic sanctions against the country in April 2012. For the first time ever, Canada is in the process of setting up an embassy in Yangon. As Myanmar continues to make headlines in Canada and around the world for reformist efforts, Golden Harp Taxi members urge listeners to understand that the realities of most people in Myanmar are still shaped by the military government's long and repressive legacy. On March 16, 1988, students protesting an end to one-party rule marched from Yangon University to another university nearby. Lin Ma Tet describes the regime's violent response to the demonstration.
So when they reached there, they blocked from this side and that side. so they have no place to run. Mm-hmm. So some are running to the water. So they, for the girl, they pull their hair and drown in the water. And some were ran into the quarter. Also, we heard that many student girls were raped in the interrogation system. After that, they closed the university, so they have no record today who were arrested, who were tied.
How many people do you think were killed?
More than 40 or 50, but this is not a sure record.
It's very, obviously very different right now.
They didn't know anything. It's nearly more than 25 years.
Because now we're looking very pleasant scene, some new sort of gardens, people strolling on Sunday afternoon. Do people remember this history? Do they know this history?
Mostly they didn't know, because this is a hidden history in our country. Because most of these people are under 20, so they didn't know it.
Next, we drove north to Insane Prison, spelled I-N-S-E-I-N, which is known worldwide for its inhumane and unhealthy conditions, perpetuation of abuse, and use of mental and physical torture. Over the course of its history, the prison has been used largely to repress activists and political dissidents. Xinming So was arrested in 1996 at a pro-democracy demonstration and incarcerated at Insane for the first part of his sentence. He was released in October 2002. Nguyen Ma Thet's husband and father were both incarcerated there after the uprisings of 1988. Nguyen Ma Thet's husband was just released in 2012. According to the Thai-based organization Assistance Association for Political Prisoners Burma, also known as AAPP Burma, there were 1,998 political prisoners in Myanmar at the end of August 2011.
Now we are going to the Insane Prison.
Insane Prison.
But this is what you can see from outside.
And that's where our driver was in prison?
And first he was arrested in Yangon, so sent to the Insane. And then sent him to Mandalay, then to the Minjiang.
Is it hard for him to go back to the prison where he spent so much time?
I told him about the This is the one of the hardest time for his life. The British government built the prison for 5,000 prisoners, but now they use for 8,000 or 9,000 prisoners in this one. But we didn't know the. But in like 1988, 2007 time, more than 10,000. At that time, between 11,000 or 13,000.
Over capacity.
At that time, is from outside the wall, this country is changing. But inside in Myanmar, we are still a lot of difficulty. In Myanmar, only two layers, top layer and bottom layer, grassroots people and crony
connected to the government.
Most of the people are grassroots.
We finished the tour by driving by the Myanmar Convention Center, where commemorations took place in August 2013 to commemorate the 25th anniversary of the uprisings in 1988, which launched the country's pro-democracy movement. This was the first time the anniversary has been commemorated in Yangon. For more information on Golden Harp Taxi, search the name online. To support political prisoners in Burma, please visit Assistance Association for Political Prisoners at aappb.com.
Over 100 people showed up at the Kamloops Area Preservation Association protest against the highly controversial Ajax Mine project that is being proposed within the city limits. And Chris Albanati from CFBX in Kamloops was there.
At a national level, we typically only hear about the major resource projects. They all have well-known names. The Tar Sands, the Ring of Fire, Northern Gateway, Keystone XL. All of these projects are massive, and they all seem to sit in between two completely opposed points of view. One side says that if these projects go ahead, they'll likely destroy the land. The other side says that without these projects, we'll likely destroy the economy. Both sides agree that the risk is too great, but they disagree about what is at risk. Now, a lot of the time, people will be for or against these kinds of things on principle. But when the project threatens to move in next door, that is often when attitudes change. That is when the impacts, both environmental and economic, become realized. I live on Tsleil-Waututh territory, in a province Canadians call British Columbia, in a city called Kamloops. The name of the city comes from the Tsleil-Waututh word Tsleil-Waututh, which literally means where the rivers meet. The center of the city is situated here. It's marked by a beautiful public park that looks out at the point where the North and South Thompson Rivers meet. We're not a big city, about 100,000 people live here. They live in houses that build out from the center of the city. Communities and the roads that connect them swirl away from the point where the rivers meet. They go up the mountainsides and down the valleys. Trace these communities to its southernmost point and you'll eventually run into another center of the city. Within the city's municipal boundaries and less than a mile from an elementary school is the proposed site of the Ajax Copper Mine. This is a center for opposing points of view. The size of the project's man-made components literally dwarfs the natural features around it. For example, the tailings storage facility would be 50 stories high, 1.5 kilometers wide, and 3 kilometers in length. It would tower over the natural hills around it. And the open pit mine, the heart of it all, will be 2.5 kilometers wide and reach 0.5 kilometer into the earth. The proposed open pit would make the neighboring Jacko Lake look like a puddle. Altogether, the size of the project rivals the size of the city. If the project goes ahead, some people say it will destroy the city. They say if the air pollution, noise, and ground tremors from the persistent rock blasting doesn't do it, then the exodus of professionals and other residents will. Consider that the wait list to find a family doctor here is years long. Many of these doctors have publicly pledged to simply pack up and leave if the Ajax mine goes ahead. The mine will destroy the city, some people say. But there are other people who say differently. There are other people in this community who passionately support the project. What do they say? What points do they make? Believe it or not, these people are really hard to find. I've heard all the talking points from the mining company, KGHM International. I've heard both the provincial and federal governments tell their versions of the action plan. But what does the average pro-Ajax person in the community have to say? How do I find these people to ask them? As it turns out, sometimes they find you. And that is where our story begins.
So now we know.
I'm standing in the crowd at the first public rally against the proposed Ajax mine. About 200 people are here gathered on the steps of a building at Thompson Rivers University. The protest was moving along pretty typically when suddenly, out of nowhere, this happened. That was a black Hummer filled with Ajax supporters that rolled up to within inches of the crowd and started revving its engine. The act was largely ignored by the rest of the protest. But for those in the immediate area, I could tell a spark had been lit. I walked over. The first person I talked to was a man standing there with his daughter.
I don't know if these guys have thought what it's like. A bunch of big guys turning up with beer cans, smoking, shouting, driving a foot behind me with a vehicle, revving the thing, and intimidating young kids. Is that what mining's all about? The kind of people who are going to be
avoided? That's what mining's about? What does that have anything to do with mining?
Now, for the record, I didn't see the beer cans, but the intimidation seemed real to me. And I know the point the guy with the accent is trying to make. For years, groups have been connecting mining projects all over the world with major human rights violations. Given that 3 out of 4 mining companies operate out of Canada, these allegations are often linked to Canadian companies. The recent case linking Hudbay Minerals to incidents of gang rape and shootings in Guatemala are a good example. So what the guy with the accent is suggesting, in a roundabout way, is that the chickens are coming home to roost. But the supporters of the Ajax mine don't see it that way. They don't see any connection between their overt display of intimidation and mining. They are making different connections.
Why do you want to deprive these young people from jobs?
I'm not trying to deprive anybody from a job.
Well, that's what you're doing. That's 500 jobs right there you're depriving people from.
Where's the money so come
not
from?
Not to mention the fucking runoff that comes from
so
all the extra
a, let's
money.
Let's have a nuclear power station on the edge of town.
You want more money for schools and hospitals, schools for your child. Where's that money going to come from? If it doesn't come from resource extraction. come from taxation, you and I.
This went on for a long time, both sides making points that the other thought was irrelevant to the issue. Since it was still sitting there, I walked over and talked to the driver of our infamous black Hummer that we heard earlier.
Can I get your name?
Gavin McGraw.
Are you a student here at TRU?
Yes, I am. Heavy duty mechanic.
So I guess I'll ask, why are you guys here?
To support Ajax, man.
Why do you support Ajax?
Because it creates jobs.
How many jobs do you think it'll create?
Oh, directly 500, indirectly thousands.
And how long?
No, they're not.
Guys, I'm trying to do an interview. And
the shouting went on for a bit, but eventually we got back to the interview.
So how long do you think those jobs will last?
17 years, I'd say.
So you think you yourself will be employed for 17 years here in this area?
Yeah, I'm already employed at other mines here, and it's created tons of jobs, thousands. And then they'll find more mines. Exploration. Ground keeps rolling. How big the world is, you have no idea. How many mines can easily be created.
When you're considering these choices, are you considering mainly the economic impact that you yourself personally will benefit from? And do you consider it all sort of the environmental impacts that are out there? The impact that mining has on water and things like that?
All the positives completely override that, completely. No negative impacts on the environment. They're a mine. They professionally do their job. They all control all that, believe me.
So, apparently, the world's resources are infinite. There are no environmental impacts. And mining companies never screw up. Wanting a second opinion from the pro-Ajax camp, I looked for the two guys I'd seen earlier.
How you doing, guys? My name's Chris Abinati. I'm with CFBX. I see you guys state where you stand sort of right on your shirt, so I was wondering if I could get your official comment for us.
My name is Devin Capello, and I think it's kind of garbage. You know, they just come in and start voicing their opinions, and once we come and try and voice ours, they're nah.
And how about yourself? What's your name and where?
My name is Morgan Miller. No, I'm just a simple country boy, really. And the only thing I really have to say is that Earth comes first. I'll log and mine the other planets later.
At this point, I was starting to see a pattern with the younger crowd in the pro-Ajax camp. So I tracked down the elderly gentleman that had jumped into the fray earlier. He was the one who was making points about taxes and healthcare. His name is Hubert Plant.
The sky is not going to fall down when the mine comes in. You know, the technology's changed so much there now that, you're going to get some dust, you're going to get some noise. You got to crack eggs, you want to make an omelet.
Do you live in Kamloops?
I live in Rayleigh.
Rayleigh, that's north of Kamloops, roughly.
North, up to North Thompson Valley, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't live on top of the mine. I was smart enough not to build a house on top of the mine.
Well, I guess.
They knew the mine was there before they built that subdivision up there. They built right up to the right-of-way fence, even after it was mined in the 80s and 90s. So couldn't have been that much dust, that much noise, that much. I never heard a sonic boom in Kamloops yet. I don't even know what that is. But they're afraid of that. That mine was never abandoned. It was shut down temporarily. At some point, they always intended to go back and mine it. It was never abandoned. They never give up their claim on it.
Thank you very much. Right.
By this time, the rally was over. I was just about to call it a day when I saw Secwepemc Elder Evelyn Camille. After opening the rally with a traditional prayer, she'd gone in to hear what the experts were saying at the KGHM-sponsored public information session held inside. I asked her what she thought about everything she'd seen and witnessed today.
All mining issues have great impact on the land. I was just downstairs. They're talking about blasting now. Safe blasting. You know, safe for them, but not Mother Earth. Once it's been blasted, there's no way. Once you've taken an organ from yourself when we're operated on, it can never be replaced regardless. So that is my concern, the impacts on Mother Earth, on our waters, on our air quality, and all the animals, and our children, mostly our children. We, as a traditional person, I still want to teach my grandchildren, great-grandchildren, the great medicines that our land offers. Mm-hmm. There is still a few of our people that still practice a lot of our culture and traditions.
And those medicines, they're available because of, as I understand it, because there is Secwepemc law here that applies. I was wondering if you could explain to people the Secwepemc laws and how they should be applied in this case.
Secwepemc laws is very simple and very basic, and to everyone, respect the land, respect each other, take care of the land, it will take care of you.
And with that, I'll leave it to you to make your own conclusions about mining. For Groundwire, I'm Chris Albanati at CFBX in Kamloops, British Columbia, on Secwepemc territory.
E.L. Jones, the poet laureate of Halifax, shared a poem about rape at a recent rally at St. Mary's University. Hilary Beaumont from the Halifax Media Co-op has that recording for Groundwire.
I'm here as a poet, but I'm also here as a woman of color and a university student myself, a graduate student. So we know that this problem doesn't belong to SMU. SMU didn't create rape culture. SMU isn't the only campus in Canada where this is happening. It's happening on the Dalhousie campus. We see it on campuses across Canada. So SMU got caught, but everybody else has been doing it. So we're not just here today as for people from the SMU community, but for people from university communities in our whole city to acknowledge this. And especially as a black woman, we know that women of color are the most vulnerable to rape and to violence. So we need to represent here and have our voices heard in this city. So I wrote this poem for today. One of the things it says in the press release is, "We are tired of being silenced." So this poem is about silence. We are the quiet. The ones who drop out of classes because our rapist is sitting beside us. Who leave circles of friends because our rapist is intertwined. We lie about being too sick or too tight. We will never say why we disappear. We cry in the shower so no one sees our tears. We sob into pillows when no one's around to hear. We tell ourselves we should have been more careful. We should have been more fearful. We swallow our words deep down in our intestines where no one can ever find we are the quiet. We pretend that we are fine. We watch our grades begin to slide when we can't concentrate. Our roommates ask us why we are acting so dry and we can't explain. We push our friends away. We are the rumor in the residence hall, the dirty whisper, the reputation. We wear the labels because we cannot say. We stop going to parties and to games. We are afraid to go on dates. We avoid going home for vacation, camouflage our weight loss or weight gain. We live silently with the shame. We lock the doors and check the window frame. We can never speak its name. Our mouths will never frame the word rape, so we write it off as a mistake. We don't let ourselves relate to anti-rape campaigns. We deny to keep ourselves safe. We rewind and rewind, reliving it over and over again. We wonder if others can see the stain. We scrub in the shower and watch blood go down the drain. We feel like we can never be sterilized. We pretend to be all right. We are the quiet. We nod and smile when people say he's such a good guy. We hide in dorm rooms. We huddle in bed. We stay inside, buried under piles of silence, and we never tell. We blame ourselves. We have learned to pretend that nothing happened. We have learned to protect ourselves. We wrap ourselves inside a shell. We convince ourselves that all is well. We never tell. We are the ones who stay friends with our rapists because we don't know what else to do. We are the ones whose texts will be used against us if we ever speak the truth, and we will be accused of changing our minds because a true victim could never be confused. We learn the excuses by heart. We rationalize that at least it didn't leave a mark. We are the mute. We are the ones told by counselors to not be such a prude. We are told it's just a part of university life and to stop being so uptight. The ones told by the health clinic to just not drink so much next time. We are told that only ugly girls would mind. We are told it's just in fun, it's just a joke, to just go along with the crowd. They are so loud and we are the quiet. We are the ashamed. We blame ourselves. We have learned not to walk at night, to stay where it's bright, to avoid elevators and the stairwell. We decide our skirt was too short or our heels were too high. We should never have advertised if we had nothing to sell. We never tell. We are taught not to yell. We believe that women lie. The victims wake up the next day and just change their minds. We are told we are only feeling false regrets. We can't forget, so we stay locked up tight. We are the socialized to be nice. We are taught to be polite. We are taught to nod and smile. We are told if we didn't want it, then why didn't we fight? We are the quiet. We are the punchline. We laugh at rape jokes so that no one ever knows. We don't want to be exposed, so we agree that, yeah, some girls are just hoes. We watch our friends roll their eyes about how some women just love to be offended. We don't intend to be one of those, so we pretend that all along we chose. We don't want to draw attention, so we have learned to never mention we are the quiet. And when everyone around us stays so quiet too, we have no idea what else we could do. Everyone around us seems to buy it. Nobody around us seems to want to fight it. It's everywhere we look, and no one seems to mind it, so we just stay quiet.
That's all for this edition of Groundwire. Make sure to tune in to our next episode, produced by CILU-FM in Thunder Bay, Ontario.
This edition was hosted and produced by volunteers at CJLY-FM in Nelson, BC, on Sinek's traditional territory.
We thank contributors Portia LeRae, Chris Albertini, Una Jefferson, the Halifax Media Co-op, and Catherine Fisher.